thanks to Steve Dowsett. Now to introduce Steve Pullman.
Thank you, Honourable Chairman, comrades and friends. We are living in a period of increasing darkness and intensifying fear for those of us in our society who dissent from what our masters and moralisers deem to be normal social behaviour. The upholders of capitalism offer us a hollow rhetoric of freedom, which turns out in reality to mean that you can survive only if you can buy the right to survive. That you're free to live as you please, only if what you please pleases the state and the ruling class. As we meet this weekend, the state is pursuing with pernicious zeal a crusade to stamp out that which is loony, queer, unnatural, and abnormal, to use its own sick vocabulary. An indication of the climate of totalitarianism, which is in the air at the moment, is the bigoted backing which the present government is now giving, and the present opposition is certainly not making any noise about opposing, to the notorious Clause 28 of the Local Government Bill, a law which makes clear that in future it will be a crime to be supportive towards those who do not conform to the state's ideal of normal sexuality. Now, let's be under no illusion about this, comrades and friends. If Clause 28 becomes law, as it already is in more extreme cases in most other countries in the world, including the so-called socialist and communist countries, where it is a crime punishable by imprisonment to be a non-heterosexual, then not only will it provide a legal license for widespread homophobia, not only will it lead to the suicide of countless numbers of young workers who are going to be denied any kind of funded counselling in our hour of need, but also we shall have on the statute book a law to outlaw the right of those who wish to promote the case for abnormality. And who is to say that once one transgression against normality is criminalised, that the bosses are not going to use the same laws and the same precedents to outlaw other transgressions against moral normality which happen to offend them? So I'd say to you, look after those who may not even be in the position that you're in, because you might be next. But not only from Clause 28 do we scent the whiff of fascism. In Britain today, we have a press which, in its depiction of women as humiliated objects of instantly consumable sexual desire, not only degrades the image of every single woman, whether she decides to go on page 3 of The Sun or not, not only acts as what seems to me, at least, as a non-lawyer, as an mass incitement for people to rape other people, but in relation to men, which we're talking about now, the men at whom the page 3 thrills are directed have their own sensuality impoverished. They are the people who are equally the victims of that, in that they have had what is a caring capacity within human beings to love other people, distorted by the press into a short, heavy-breathing fantasy designed for sun-reading masturbators. And there's nothing else which can be said about it except that the press acts as an incitement to pervert that which is loving and which is about real desire in human beings. And there is something else I want to mention, which is part of this frighteningly oppressive drift towards the persecution of abnormal workers in our society. And it's something which is rarely mentioned, particularly by the left, because the left have had a very big part in building up this particular factor. There exists within the psychiatric industry a dangerous degree of state-enforceable power existing specifically to drug people, to incarcerate people against their will, to categorize people as being mad. And this places tens of thousands of our fellow workers, as we sit here today, in detention by the state, under total control of the state, under the Mental Health Act, and there's nothing they can do to get out of it. And make no mistake about it, our fellow workers who are in what are euphemistically called psychiatric hospitals, and I would call psychiatric prisons, are in there very often as we speak right now. Most of them women, incidentally. The majority of people sectioned into psychiatric hospitals are women. Not of their own choosing, and largely for the reason that they have rejected the image of femininity and the family values which they've been pressurized to accept throughout their life. And similarly, there are many men being detained by the state today, being cured of the disease of not living up to the image of proper manhood. Now, my comrade Dowsett has more than adequately spoken about how we are conditioned into this image of proper manhood. And I have nothing at all to add about the image of proper manhood. Who am I to talk about the image of proper manhood? If anyone ever sees images of proper manhood growing in me, should they take me aside and tell me? What I do intend to speak about is how the image of proper manhood has emerged historically and how the idea of male supremacy has evolved. Because it's only by comprehending what men have been conditioned to see themselves as in society, I would argue, that we'll see how society actually defines femininity, defines the role of woman. Because in a passage in one of the great works on this subject, I think, by Simone de Beauvoir called The Second Sex, she made a statement which, since I read it, has always stuck with me. She says, and I quote, "Woman is defined and differentiated with reference to man, and not he with reference to her. She is incidental, the inessential, as opposed to the essential. He is the subject. He is the absolute. She is the other." The remainder of what I have to say in this talk will be an historical investigation of how women have become in relation to men, the other, even in terms of our popular cliches, a bit of the other. I'm going to start with theology. In the beginning was God. And although there is no known evidence that God had a penis and a pair of balls, there is widespread knowledge that he didn't have a vagina. And therefore, God is a he. And not all gods have always been men. Before the beginning, because you must realise that theology defines the beginning as the date when that particular god got the franchise over screwing people's minds up. But before then, there had been societies which had not been economically dominated by males, and they had invented female gods called goddesses. For example, instead of the Garden of Eden, the Greeks had the Garden of Hesperides, which was ruled over by a goddess called Hera. And in his classical anthropological work, The Sexual Life of Savages, Malinowski reported that the Trobriand Islanders believed that the sun had been created by a woman who created all of the earth. But after she created the sun, she kept some of her power that she'd used to create the sun. And where did she keep it? In that special little place that women have. And therefore, men, in order to regain this power, had to constantly try to get into that place in order to rob her of it. Now, that's what the Trobriand Islanders thought. And my barber thinks the same thing, incidentally. But the Judeo-Christian God, which is the person who most of us have been taught to worship because we fear him, because he'll attack us if we don't worship him, was certainly a man. Worse still, the Judeo-Christian God was a misogynist. He hated women. The book of Genesis, which is the theological account of how we were created and made to be as we always must be, went through several versions. According to the earliest Hebrew translation, which I have read, this was the chronology of events at the time of the creation. I quote, God made a garden in Eden, also a man named Adam to be its overseer, and planted it with trees. He then created all beasts, birds, creeping things, and lastly, woman. So woman was a sort of divine afterthought to keep the creeping things company. And because a lot of women would say, well, we spent a lot of creeping things company. The more popular story about the creation of woman comes from a later version of the Old Testament, much later version of the Old Testament, which is because Eve was created out of Adam. Again, this story is a relatively recent invention. If we go back into the 5th century, for example, we find in commentaries by the rabbis, they were the only people commenting on the Bible at the time, in what were called their midrashes, which is simply the Hebrew word for commentary. If we look at a 5th century version of the book of Genesis, we find that before God created Eve, he actually had created another first woman to be a friend for Adam, and she was called Lilith. But she was dissolved into thin air for refusing to be subordinate to Adam. Let me quote from this 5th century midrash so that you will know what it says. I quote, Adam and Lilith never found peace together. For when he wished to lie with her, she took offense at the recumbent posture he demanded. Why must I lie beneath you, she asked. I was also made from dust and am therefore your equal. But Adam tried to compel her to obedience by force. Lilith, in a rage, uttered the magic name of God, rose into the air, and dissolved. So, there you are, girls. Think carefully tonight. But you see, Malinowski incidentally found exactly the same thing with the Trobriand Islanders. He found that there was equally a belief that when the Christian missionaries first went there, the term missionary position had actually come precisely from this restricted and very limited way of lovemaking that the Christians had brought over. And it was, in fact, the Trobriand Islanders who gave it the name the missionary position. Prior to then, they'd enjoyed themselves a lot more. When God did finally get around to creating Eve, who knew her place, she then screwed things up by being tempted by the serpent, which was, of course, sent by God in order to make her screw it up. In fact, Eve screwed things up in a terrible way. She really was the person who committed the original sin, according to theology. And it was because Eve sinned that we are all born sinners forevermore, according to theology. In other words, she committed the original sin, and the all-loving, ever-forgiving God said, okay, Eve, you've sinned. Right, I'm banishing you from paradise and every future generation as well. So he sort of had an all-loving, all-forgiving approach to the problem. And he said to her, as she was walking out of the Garden of Eden, according to the Bible, I will greatly... and he also said, and I quote, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And from then on, both Judaism and Christianity was quite firm in its view that you couldn't trust women. You have to keep women in their place. Let me offer you just a few random examples. If we turn to the 8th century version of the story of the flood, you all remember the flood, of course. The flood was when the all-loving, ever-forgiving God decided to drown everyone because they weren't showing him enough respect. And according to this 5th century version, God made the flood because women didn't know their place. Let me quote you from this 8th century account of God's instructions to Noah as to who should be allowed into the ark and be saved. I quote, if the male lorded it over the female of his own kind, both were admitted, but not otherwise. For females frequently lorded it over males. God decided to destroy all creatures whatsoever, except those that obeyed his will. Another example is the biblical story of Samson and Delilah, Old Testament story of a man allows himself to become seduced by a woman, and he is very strong, she is very weak and passive. He cuts her hair, and she cuts his hair, and he loses his strength. And it's interesting that Margaret Mead, in a book called Male and Female, found the same thing in the North American Indians of Northern California, the I think they're called the Yurok Indians, because what she found was that men would only ever have sexual intercourse with women out of doors. They wouldn't do it inside where they kept their possessions, because they always wanted other men to be around as witnesses. Their view was that if you had sexual intercourse in public where other people could watch, the woman couldn't seduce you and steal away all of your possessions. If you had it inside, then she would. And as a result, Margaret Mead observed that there was a very strange pattern of births amongst the North Californian Indians. By the time of the New Testament, all of this was settled, and St. Paul sums it up very clearly in his first epistle to the Corinthians, when he says, and I quote, "Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in public." Well, there we are. Maybe Margaret Thatcher is a Christian, after all. By the 17th century, the poet Milton, who was probably one of the most miserable Christians ever to write really good poetry, was able to sum it all up when he wrote in his poem called Samson Agonistes, which was all about warning men not to be like Samson and let women cut their hair during the night and lose your strength. He said, "Therefore, God's universal law gave to the man despotic power over his female in due awe." So much for God's universal law, which was clearly written by men for those men who had power in society at that time. Now let's turn to the post-religious ideology of male supremacy and see how that worked. In the 17th and 18th centuries occurred what historians have called the Enlightenment. After centuries of looking up into the sky every time people wanted to explain something, they started looking down to earth, and they discovered their own rationality, their own ability to reason. Instead of supernatural powers being invoked to explain things, human powers were looked at. Instead of the divine right of kings, whereby the state was only answerable to God, you had people like John Locke and Rousseau arguing that it was for human beings to decide how society was to run. Now, as Engels quite rightly pointed out in Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, the so-called Enlightenment was in fact a capitalist enlightenment. Its science was essentially only as rational as capitalism allowed people to become rational. Its political social contract was based upon a theory of freedom, which was essentially freedom for capitalists to decide things. But what is not so frequently commented upon is that most of the Enlightenment thinkers and the social contract thinkers were also thinking in predominantly male terms about politics. For example, in 1762, Rousseau wrote a book called Emile, or its subtitle was On Education. Now, Rousseau was probably one of the intellectual giants of this period. It was Rousseau who was the man who said, "People are reasonable, they have a chance to be equal, we're born free, we're put into chains. People have got to be allowed to determine their own fate without all of these feudal bondage tying them down." But when it came to writing about how to educate women, Rousseau slipped a bit from his egalitarian ideals. For example, let me quote from Emile about how to educate a woman. He says, and I quote, "A woman's education must be planned in relation to man, to be pleasing in his sight, to win his respect and love, to train him in childhood, to tend him in manhood, to counsel and console, to make his life pleasant and happy. These are the duties of woman for all time. And this is what she should be taught while she's young." Now, why does Rousseau, the philosopher who rises to significance in 1754 with a work called The Discourse on Inequality, which argues that people shouldn't accept all of these so-called natural impediments to equality, why does he then go on to say that one huge section of the human species has got to be subordinated. In Emile, this is how Rousseau explains the exclusion clause for women. He says, and I quote, "Women do wrong to complain of the inequality of man-made laws. This inequality is not of man's making, or at any rate, it is not the result of mere prejudice, but of reason. She to whom nature has entrusted the care of the children must hold herself responsible for them to their father." So Rousseau uses reason, which is the new god of the Enlightenment, to keep mothers in obedience to fathers, in exactly the same way as the Enlightenment philosophers were using reason to keep workers in a robbed and subordinate position to capitalists. Rousseau goes on then to make what is a fundamentally important point in the whole history of the theory of patriarchy. And he makes it in his book, Emile, and I think it's worth quoting because it will cover some of the ground that I'm going to cover in the next few minutes. He says, and I quote, "The search for abstract and speculative truths, for principles and axioms in science, for all that tends to wide generalization, is beyond a woman's grasp. Their studies should be thoroughly practical. It is their business to apply the principles discovered by men. A woman's thoughts, beyond the range of her immediate duties, should be directed to the study of men, for the works of genius are beyond her reach, and she has neither the accuracy nor the attention for success in the exact sciences." Now, I want to make 2 points about what I've just quoted. The first point is that it was written in the middle of the 18th century, and who else was writing similar things at that time? I'll tell you who. White racists were writing exactly the same things about black people. Only white people are capable of understanding the sciences. Black people may well be able to run a bit faster, and they may well be able to have certain other attributes, but of course, they're never going to be capable of abstract thinking. The difference is that whereas today none of these white racists of the 18th century are taught in our universities, we regard them with ridicule and contempt. It's interesting that in almost every university in this country where people learn about the great philosophers, Rousseau is regarded as one of the great men of reason to whom we should all look with admiration. And I think it's interesting that we look in other ways at him as well. Secondly, I want to draw your attention to Rousseau's claim that women cannot become geniuses, whatever a genius may be. And this, of course, is the point, whatever a genius may be. Because if a genius is determined in terms of male abilities, then of course a woman isn't going to become a genius. In exactly the same way as, for example, somebody might say, you're never going to find a good socialist economist. Absolutely right. Because economics is the study of managing the artificial scarcity of the profit system. And socialists who want to abolish the profit system are never going to be very good at managing it. In precisely the same way, if you establish a term which defines what a man is, what a genius is, what a woman is, in certain ways, then you exclude certain categories from ever reaching that position. So essentially, Rousseau's theory, which we can call the men have got good brains, women have got big hearts theory, was a load of old balls. And talking of that, we now move on to the biological theories of the 19th century. And in the 19th century, human beings apparently reached the pinnacle of the age of science. They didn't, of course, at all. What happened was that philosophers started saying we can't actually identify any differences between men and women in the brain. So they went down and looked between their legs and said, surely this is going to teach us what makes people intelligent. In 1871, Charles Darwin published his second important book about evolution, which was called The Descent of Man in Relation to Sex. Now, this was an incredibly popular book. It was so popular that it was reprinted 24 times between 1871 when it first came out and 1901. And in it, Darwin makes the following assertion, and it's an interesting assertion. I quote, "Man is more courageous, pugnacious, and energetic than woman, and has a more inventive genius. The social Darwinists who took up this theory and developed it and distorted it out of all proportion, they made as much as they could out of Darwin having said this, proceeded to argue that there was a biological determination of women's inferiority, men's superiority. And the main person to do this was somebody called Patrick Geddes, who published a book which was to have a major impact called The Evolution of Sex. His biological theory, which has since been discredited in the light of our current century's understanding about sexual chromosomes and hormones, was very simple. It was that the female cell is very strong and well-fed, whereas the male cell is very weak and hungry. Therefore, men have a biological drive to have to be more energetic, more inventive, to think more, to spend more of their mental energy building up their cells, and women, on the contrary, don't have this incentive. And Geddes goes on to state, and I quote, "It is generally true that the males are more active, energetic, eager, passionate, and variable. The females more passive, conservative, sluggish, and stable." Wouldn't necessarily be worth quoting that, were it not for the fact that for something like 30 years, this was the established view in Western Europe about female biology and its relationship to female abilities. So what happened in the last century was that what theology had years earlier determined to be a law of God now was turned into a law of science. Not much difference. Let me give you some very brief examples then of some of the people putting this theory that I've just defined. In his book, The Philosophy of Right, Hegel explains that, and I quote, "One sex exhibits power and mastery, while the other is subjective and passive. Hence, a husband has his real, essential life in the state and the sciences. In the family, the wife has her full substantive place, and in the feeling of family piety, realizes her ethical disposition." W.E.H. Lecky wrote in his History of European Morals, also written in the last century, I think it was written in the last century, and I quote, "Men excel in energy, self-reliance, perseverance, and magnanimity." He didn't mention modesty as one of the "women in humility, gentleness, modesty, and endurance." And J.M. Allen, whose book Woman Suffrage Wrong was one of the many books published in the 1890s to oppose giving women the vote, pointed out that, I quote, "To man belongs the kingdom of the head, to woman the empire of the heart." So these are just some random examples that I've chosen. I've got a collection of those of them. I like collecting examples of idiocy. Of this, men have got minds, women have got caring abilities. I want now to turn to one other biological theory, which has been invoked in defense of sexual inequality, and I think needs to be dealt with. It's what we might call the anthropomorphic fallacy, or at least that's what they call it in my local pub. Saying to one another, "You're committing the anthropomorphic fallacy again." What some defenders of male power say is that you can look at animal cultures, and then they say, "Look, we see quite distinctly that the males are dominant and the females are subordinate. Therefore, human men must be naturally dominant." For example, let me quote from one very well-respected academic writer, by the name of Tiger, incidentally. I don't know whether it's because he's called Tiger that his thinking goes wonky, but he states the following in a book called Men in Groups. I actually took it out of the library in order to try and get something about the Rolling Stones, but it said, and I quote, "The fact that males are stronger than females, that they are more directly socialized to accept and use violence, that they form the major structures of defense and police in all communities, all generally reflect the genetically pre-programmed behavioral disposition." But he then has to go on, having made this claim that there was this genetically pre-programmed behavioral disposition, people say, "Hey, Tiger, what is it?" And he then goes on to say, and this is his argument, I quote from his book, the leadership structure of baboon troops can be seen to be male-dominated, Therefore, the management of crises in any species is usually the function of males. To follow that logic is rather like saying that the ginger tomcat near where I live is a randy little swine, therefore let's castrate the chairman. It's not, in fact, a proposition that we can accept. Boy baboons may indeed lord it over lady baboons in the kind of way that would get them plenty of free tickets into Noah's Ark. But, on the other hand, we are not baboons. And it seems rather odd in the 1980s to have to be arguing that we are not baboons and that they've got baboon nature and we have a different ability to change consciously our environment. What I want to turn to in conclusion is how men have responded historically to women who don't like this idea of male power. The first thing that men have done to women who don't like male power is they killed them. This is a very direct way of responding to a threat that they have found. One of the most famous accounts, which was written about at great length, in fact, I think rather unhealthy length, by Foucault in his two-volume History of Sexuality, was the case of the Norman peasant Pierre Riviere, who, in 1825, murdered his mother because she owned the land on which he and his father had to work. And in his trial, he made it very clear that rather than being humiliated by a woman and having to work for her, he would rather kill her and endure a life sentence in prison. In fact, he didn't get his way. He killed his mother and endured a life sentence in a lunatic asylum instead. But at least Riviere only murdered one woman. Jacob Sprenger, the author of the Malleus Maleficarum, which was the medieval textbook on how to spot a witch, was responsible for the murder, usually by being burnt alive, not incidentally in England. In England, they didn't burn witches alive. They would hang them by the neck because they thought it was more humane over here one time. And thousands of European women died. And incidentally, it's very hard to know how many witches died as a result of the persecution of witches. And that itself is a piece of history which I think is worth asking, why don't we know how many women died? Sprenger argued that because women were more passionate than men, they were ideal tools to be used by Satan. His book is an obscene specimen of women hatred, and I'll quote just one extract from it. Quote, "Woman is a wheedling and secret enemy, and that she is more perilous than a snare does not speak of the snare of hunters, but of devils. All witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is in women insatiable." This was not just the ravings of a lunatic. It was, in fact, the ravings of a lunatic. But it was the ravings of a lunatic at a time when most people were lunatics, and furthermore, the lunatics were in charge. In 1484, Pope Innocent VIII, and he would have been called Pope Guilty VIII had he not controlled the judges, he published a bull in 1484 calling for the church to hunt out witches all across Europe. The vast majority of witches who were killed were simply women who had not agreed to become the possessions of men. They were spinsters, they were women who, having been married, had left their husbands, or alternatively, and equally tragically, they were epileptics. Looking back now at the Malleus Maleficarum, we see that the way to spot a witch is almost entirely a definition which we now know medically is a study of epilepsy. But when male power was not being defended by brutal force, it's been defended in other ways, and ways that we've all got to be careful about, men and women as workers. And that is by ridicule. Easiest way to knock down an argument, socialists know that. Rousseau, who I've tried to expose for what he was, detested the idea of a female who exhibited any kind of intelligence. He complained that, and I quote, "From the lofty height of her genius, she scorns every womanly duty, and she is always trying to make a man of herself." And this is a claim that you will hear time and time again about women who attempt to be intelligent, that they really want to be men. The second very common insult you'll hear is that women who show any signs of intelligence are, in fact, lesbians. They are, in fact, homosexuals. Simone de Beauvoir was incredibly upset in 1949 when her book, The Second Sex, was published, and a Catholic reviewer in one of the newspapers wrote a book review of it, which said this is in fact the cry of a frustrated homosexual. She took that very badly, mainly because she was a foolish slave in love to Jean-Paul Sartre. That's another question. And the third insult that will often be thrown at women who wish to exhibit intelligence is that the reason women try to be intelligent is basically because they are not proper women, because they are not good at doing what women ought to be doing, which is on their back and smiling. For example, in a letter to the Times on the 28th of March 1912, Sir Almroth E. Wright, who was the author of a book called The Unexpurgated Case Against Woman Suffrage, wrote that, and I quote, "The recruiting field for the militant suffragists is a million of our excess female population. That million, which had better long ago have gone out to mate with its complement of men upon the seas." So in other words, if you're a woman who doesn't like being inferior, it's only because you're surplus to the population and can't find a man. Go and emigrate, find a place where there are too many men, and maybe they're becoming womanly, and you'll get on fine. Perhaps I should leave the final words to Otto Weininger. And I'm very glad that I think no one here would have heard of him. He was an Austrian philosopher of the 1890s who committed suicide at the age of 23 when the world refused to acknowledge that his book entitled Sex and Character was the work of an outstanding genius. In fact, it was a work of an outstanding bigot whose main problem in life was he couldn't make up his mind whether he hated Jews more than women or women more than Jews. And because he committed suicide at 23, they found a book half completed, which was an attack on Jews. But he at least managed to finish his one attacking women. And he wrote, and I quote, "A genius is a man with the most intense, most vivid, most conscious, most continuous, and most individual ego. Women have no existence and no essence. They are not. They are nothing. Mankind occurs as male or female, as something or nothing. The meaning of woman is to be meaningless. She represents negation, the opposite pole from God, the only other possibility of humanity." Of course, not very long after that book was published, millions of Jews and homosexuals and people who didn't accept what I think Clause 28 calls valid social relationships were marched into the extermination camps. They were deemed to be the nothings of humanity. It's now half a century since the stench of Nazism contaminated Europe. But intellectually, that time is getting nearer to us, not further.